Well, I appreciate the invitation to speak. It was 26 years ago, you're right, Jeff, in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I was just starting my career when we had the first symposium on long-term research, and I was the lead speaker there, and I was given the subject of an overview of America's long-term research. And Jeff asked me to talk about that today, but I said, it's impossible. There's so much going on that I would feel very inadequate trying to give an overview, but this is my overview. By my count, there are at least four experiments, agronomic experiments across the United States that are established before 1900. Of course, the Mara plots being the oldest, the Sanborn Field at Missouri being the second oldest, and the Magruder plots at Oklahoma State being the third oldest. And all of these involve grain crops and cropping systems. But when I started my career at Auburn University over 30 years ago, I was asked to manage an experiment that had been going on. I just knew it was an old experiment. And I took on that responsibility, and it has been the pleasure of my career to work with these long-term experiments. So today, I'd like to share with you a little bit about the oldest continuous cotton experiments in the world. And they're both of these experiments are located on the campus of Auburn University, and I'd like to invite you, if you're ever down that way, to come by and let me show them to you, because I think they tell a very interesting story, not only of cotton production in the South, but also of what our agronomic history has done to our soils in the southern region. As I said, both of these experiments are on highly weathered ultisols, candy udults, typical of the southeastern United States, where cotton production was king 100 to 150 years ago. And I'm told that at that time you could travel from Montgomery, Alabama to Atlanta, Georgia and not see a tree, because it was all the land was plowed up, planted to cotton, and for every acre of cotton there was also an acre of corn to feed the people that worked the land. But both of these experiments were started near the campus on farmland back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. The old rotation is the oldest of the two experiments, started in 1896. We know it's the oldest cotton experiment in the world, even though the historical marker says the oldest in the United States. Shortly after we erected the historical marker, there was a long-term symposium in Rothamsted, England, for the whole world, and we found out that nobody else has a cotton experiment any older. It's the oldest cover crop study in the South, and maybe one of the oldest cover crop studies in the United States. And it's the third oldest agronomic experiment in the United States on the same site. And it also on the National Register of Historical Places in 1988. Its sister experiment, which is located a few hundred yards away, is called the Colors Rotation, and it was named for the farmer that owned the land at the time the experiment was started in 1911. It is the oldest soil fertility study in the South, and perhaps one of the oldest in the United States. It's the second oldest cotton study, second only to the old rotation, and it's on the site where we think potash deficiency was discovered as a major, yield-limiting factor on cotton around 1890. We have the documentation, and we think it was on this site, because this is a deep, sandy, candy udult soil where potash deficiency was first discovered. And we also claim that that's where the fertilizer industry really started in the South, because up until that time, a little rock phosphate was used. No nitrogen sources were used. And so this experiment really involves mainly potassium rates and other nutrients as well. And it's also on the National Register of Historical Places. To put these experiments in perspective, you have to realize what life must have been like 120, 130 years ago in the Deep South. It was all about cotton. The entire economy of the South was about cotton. And that culture took a toll on the land and our soil resources. The land was plowed in the fall, So what if we had 50 to 60 inches of rain a year and most of it fell during the winter months? That's okay. It washed away. The rivers ran red in the wintertime. I'm told that at that time a writer wrote that Alabama was bleeding to death because its rivers were running red in the wintertime. And it took its toll. I'm primarily an extension agronomist, and I tell our farmers today when I'm giving these talks that you are not farming the same land that your granddaddy farmed because of this. There have been estimates that in the Piedmont portion of Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, we've lost at least a foot of the original topsoil that was there in the early 1800s. This culture took a toll not only on the land, but the people that farmed the land. A young professor at what was then the Agricultural and Mechanical College of Alabama in East Alabama, just a relatively new land-grant university, made a statement, and he wrote this, that agriculture will come unto its own when our fields are green in winter. Now, that was a profound statement for 1896, for someone to realize that you could not continue to farm the way we had been farming, that you had to plant cover. He didn't call it cover crops. He just keep the land green in winter. And, of course, the cover crops were born in the South. Sometimes I think you're just discovering them in Minnesota, Jeff, but they were born in the South because we had this six-month period when the land was bare and nothing was being grown on it. So we don't know what the objectives of the old rotation were. They were not written down. Professor Duggar did not write them down. But he started this experiment, we think, to test his theories about keeping the land green in winter. So we think their objectives were to include crop rotations, and it is rotations with cotton, corn, and today soybeans and winter cover crops, and wheat is also included, with the cover crops to improve yields and provide a source of nitrogen because no nitrogen fertilizers were used. There were no nitrogen fertilizers to speak of in 1896. And it was a field laboratory. He didn't call it sustainable, but we call it sustainable today, a field laboratory for sustainable production. After exactly 100 years of conventional tillage, this experiment was switched to, we call conservation tillage, not exactly no-till, but mostly strip-till, and for the last 18, 19 years, it's been under a conservation tillage system. The land has not been inverted, the land has not been disturbed, except in the strips where we plant the crops, and we plant into a heavy cover crop residue. In 2003, we installed, trying to bring it up to date, we installed irrigation on half of the experiment. So we could, it's not, in 1896, there was no such thing as replication, agricultural statistics. So the plots were not technically replicated. There are some replicates today, but it's mostly for observation and to test Professor Duggar's theory. So we installed irrigation, and today, there are some dramatic differences. You don't need statistics to see the differences here in plots 1, 2, 3, and 4. Plots 2, 3, and 4 there. Let's see if can you... do we have a pointer? This is plot 1. Plots 2, 3, and 4 all involve cover crops. They've been treated identically. Here in the Deep South, if you don't use nitrogen fertilizers, you don't make a crop. Those first four plots have never had any nitrogen fertilizers applied to them. They're identical, except for the fact that plots 2, 3, and 4 receive a winter legume cover crop. And the yields are just as dramatic as the pictures here show. This is a ground level view of two of the plots this summer. The plot on your left is, both of these plots are identical in the fact that they've never received any nitrogen fertilizers. If you want an organic production system in the Deep South, this is it. But the plot on the right, since 1896, has been continuous cotton with no cover crops, no nitrogen fertilizers. They all get phosphorus and potassium. The plot on the left is the same system, except it's a rotation with corn and includes a winter legume cover crop. The yields this past summer were dramatic. The plot on the left, if you know anything about cotton, that's about 4 bales per acre. When Professor Duggar started his work, they were getting about a half a bale per acre at the best. The plot on the left is about 4. The plot on the right is about a bale per acre, which is twice what Professor Duggar was getting in his day, which tells you that we've made a lot of other improvements. But it's just amazing to me that we can produce 4 bales of cotton, which any farmer in the South would be glad to get, with no nitrogen fertilizer, just a winter legume. That's what it looked like in March, just before we killed the vetch cover crop. The vetch and crimson clover, but the vetch dominated. Just before we killed it to plant no-till the cotton and or the corn into those plots. These are some of the yields that we've seen over the last 12, 13 years, irrigated, non-irrigated, for the different cropping systems. And the important thing here, of course, we do see a response to irrigation. And farmers are installing irrigation throughout the Deep South. Where they can, they are putting it in. But as I said, we get around 55 inches of rain a year. So if all that rain came on Saturday evening at 6 o'clock, we would have no need for irrigation. But unfortunately, that's not the case. So particularly in South Georgia, they've been irrigating for several years, and it's moving into Alabama now. When we see data like this, and farmers realize, we get a response to irrigation about 7 out of the last 11 years. 2 of those years, we get a negative response to irrigation. But overall, we see a pretty positive response to irrigation. And wherever you have that winter legume cover crop, the yield potential is the highest here in this experiment. And corn is very similar. We're not a corn-growing region, but traditionally corn is the rotation crop with cotton. And all the corn gets either a winter legume or winter legume plus additional nitrogen fertilizers. And over the last few years since we've installed irrigation, we've had to increase those nitrogen rates because now we are pushing, we're getting well over 200 bushels of corn in some years. So we have to increase those nitrogen rates on selected plots if we're going to get the kind of yields that are expected today. And of course, we have wheat and rotated with soybeans in certain treatments there. The wheat, is not irrigated, but the soybeans are double cropped behind the wheat, and they respond to irrigation 13 out of the last 13 years. We see a dramatic response to soybeans. So this experiment is updated, and farmers enjoy it. It's primarily for our farmers and visitors. You can see these differences. You don't have to look at the statistics to see the difference. They also kind of tell a history here. This slide shows that the yield, I selected one treatment. This is a continuous cotton with a winter legume cover crop. And just to look at the yields since Professor Duggar started this in 1896, these are annual yields. Non-irrigated, by the way, so there is a lot of variability. But in 1911, the boll weevil hit the South, and you can see this experiment tells that story when the boll weevil devastated cotton production. And then they found some ways of controlling the boll weevil. Yield started increasing, started applying a little more P and K to the plots, and then World War II hit. Whatever effect that had, you can see it in these plots. After World War II, fertilizers became abundant in the South, and we actually increased the P and K rates to what they are today. And that reached a peak primarily from fertilization in the around 1960 and early 70s. And then, as you know, in 1972, DDT was lost. They had no way of controlling the insects, for a while anyway. Plus, our experiment station moved our main research station about 30 miles away from Auburn. So we had no way of really managing the plots as they should be managed. So yields plummeted. And then, of course, I came to Auburn in 1984, and you can see what's happened since then. So thank you very much. But no, we attribute this to the GMO crops and better weed control. We no longer have the boll weevil to contend with. We have the BT cotton, and yields are continuing to go up. And I attribute a lot of this to the conservation tillage that we implemented. Another interesting thing that we've seen on these experiments is back during conventional tillage, we started measuring soil organic carbon. And we see a really nice relationship just looking at nothing else but soil organic matter or organic carbon versus relative yield. Just pick a plot, call it 100% yield, compare everything to that. And I haven't seen these type data anywhere else. I'm sure they do exist, but I was really amazed. I've been thinking about this ever since we observed this back in the 90s, this nice relationship. And we see it plateauing around 2% organic matter. That would be low for the Midwest. We did a survey in Alabama, and we found that most of our cotton fields have 1% or less soil organic matter. So technically, some of those fields should not be making any cotton. Of course, they are. And recently, we have implemented a soil quality index based strongly on this relationship between soil organic matter and yield, and we went back and revisited those plots and looked at soil organic carbon versus yield on a 0 to 3 inch sample since they've been under conservation tillage, high residue management, and we see the same relationship, only the plateau has shifted to the right about 1%. So in our new soil quality index, we're using 3% as the target soil organic matter for most of our field crop production based on this relationship right here. Back in the days when this was in conservation tillage, I just picked two treatments here, the continuous cotton that gets only fertilizer nitrogen and the continuous cotton that gets winter legumes. And we see that during the days of conventional tillage, erosion was estimated to be well over T for all the plots. Since we switched in 1997 to conservation tillage, we have brought down erosion with just conventional continuous cotton with no winter legumes. We've at least brought that down to near T, near tolerance, and where we have the winter legumes, well below tolerance. And it doesn't take a soil scientist long walking out across these plots this time of the year after the crops have been harvested, looking at the soil, scraping your foot across, to see, you can see these differences. I like to take students out there and ask, with a soil sampling cube, take a sample in this plot that has had no cover crops. They can't do it. You can't, even as wet as it is, you can't hardly push it in the soil. 10 feet away, take a sample here. You can push it 18 inches deep. And that tells the story, that soil quality. That's one reason we've instituted this new soil quality test in Alabama, and there'll be a poster on it tomorrow. And I just quickly ran some numbers to see how it works on the old rotation, and it does work, because if you notice on the right-hand column, that our soil quality index is built on a scale of 0 to 100, and it is very qualitative. A qualitative index, but it clearly points out that wherever you have a legume or a winter cover crop, you've got the highest soil quality index there, and that's what we wanted to see. The other experiment that I'd like to share with you is called the colors rotation. It's just a few hundred feet away, a few hundred yards away from the old rotation. This was the experiment that was started on the site where we think potassium was discovered as a yield-limiting nutrient in the South. And this is even a more dramatic experiment, because you can, looking at this image taken from a drone last September, you can see the cotton. The cotton is on your left, the soybeans are in the middle, the corn is on your right, and those are rotated every year. There are 14 soil fertility treatments here, and some of them are dramatic. Again, great resource. There's no other place in the world that I know of where you can stand in one spot in August, see phosphorus deficiencies, potassium deficiencies, the effect of acid soils, the effect of sulfur deficiencies, the effect of micronutrients on three crops at the same time. Now, these treatments, again, 1911 was when this experiment was started. There was no randomization, so the treatments run all the way through. But you can see the, just looking at this aerial image here, no line, no crop. I love this treatment here. This is what I call the no-nothing treatment. Improper English, but it tells a story. You would get absolutely nothing off. The plant has been planted every year since 1911. Nothing has been harvested. Well, it was harvested in the early days. Today, nothing is there to harvest. Not even weeds grow in this plot. This is the no potassium plot. This is the no phosphorus plot. It looks pretty good until you look at it close. In fact, at a ground level view, the no lime plots on your left, no potassium plot on soybeans. This is the soybean crop last fall. This is the no phosphorus on cotton on your left. Looks pretty good if you didn't have anything to compare it with, and I love to take students out there and say, you can't go by the textbook pictures. This soil test T is almost non-existent, maybe one or two parts per million of malic 1 extractable phosphorus in that soil, very low. This is the no potassium on cotton taken in late August. This is what Professor Duggar and his colleagues called cotton rust. They didn't know what caused it. They knew it was devastating to cotton. Now we know it has a potash deficiency. And that's really the essence of these this experiment is to look at rates of potassium. So these experiments have been so valuable to us, I think, if nothing else, just to preserve our agronomic history in the Deep South, to tell that story of what our forefathers went through in developing modern agriculture. And we try to keep the data relevant by changing the experiments, using new varieties, new practices, conservation tillage, irrigation, and getting the kind of yields that farmers will appreciate today on their main campus of their land-grant university. And it's great for teaching, tours, and just talking. And that's what I enjoy doing, is taking visitors out, showing them this bit of our agricultural history in the Deep South. There is a website for both of these experiments, and this summer I'm real excited because we put in the first cotton cam. So you can actually go to the web today. I can't do it here, but you can click on this website and get a live image of the old rotation. And if you have nothing better to do, you can sit back in the summer and watch the cotton grow. Thank you very much.
I have to say, it's even better the second time. It was great. Thanks, Charles. We have time for a few questions. Questions? Yes, sir.
So, with respect to the long historical data that you have, what is the longest continuous information you have for a given cultivar, whether it's a corn cultivar or a cotton cultivar?
Yeah, there was about 20 years there when the same cultivar was planted in the late 50s. 60s, early 70s, and I do have that data. But as you know, varieties change almost daily. Now, I can't keep up with them. Someone asked me, what corn, cotton, and soybean varieties do you plant out there? And by the way, I didn't acknowledge my colleagues, Dr. Dennis Delaney, he's our soybean specialist, extension soybean specialist at Auburn, and Dr. Kip Balcom, who works with the USDA Soil Dynamics Lab. These fellows keep up with the varieties. And I tell folks when they ask me what variety, I say, I don't know. It's something like Pioneer or Stoneville or something with a bunch of numbers and letters after it. That's all I know.
Yes?
Have you ever gone through and
No, but we have some other experiments that are almost as old on our outlying units. And in the late 70s, one of my predecessors there did exactly what you're talking about. And these were plots that had never had anything applied to them. And it took him 3 years to get the yields up to where they were on our better fertilized plots. Just looking at fertility, nothing else.
We can take one last question.
Do you sample for nematodes on this?
Yes, we. The question was, do we sample for nematodes? Yes, and we have plant pathologists looking at all the fungi, the mycorrhizae, all that stuff also in there. So yes, there's. I try to keep a bibliography of all the research that comes off of it, but people are always out there taking samples that I don't know about.
Excellent. Let's give Charles some time.